everyone, this is Jason with the Learn Emerge podcast. As you can tell, we've got a new intro, and this is all part of the philosophy of building the plane as we fly it. It might crash, but the good news with podcasting is I can just keep recording. It won't crash too bad. So I feel bad about sitting on the conversation I had with our next guest, Dr. Brad Oliver. He's a friend of mine. We had a great conversation last summer, and hopefully you find that it's encouraging also. I think there are people that really care about students, about kids that are in places of leadership and education. And he shed some insight on how schools work, how school policy works at the State House on down, as well as insights from his own life. And he shares his tragedies and triumphs. And I think you're going to enjoy Dr. Oliver. He's somebody that one of the things I really respect about him is his ability to get to the heart of the issue and also get to the heart of the person, which that's a rare ability, and he does both very well, and I appreciate that. Back up. Okay. All right, joining us today is Dr. Brad Oliver. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Jason.
Good. Good. We're so glad you're here. You're with us here at the Remedy Live Studios, home of the Get School Tour. And you've had quite a background. We've known each other. We travel in some of the same circles. I'm excited to get your story. And you have a new role coming up in education. You've done a lot of things, and we're going to talk about that and all the leadership things you've learned.
Yeah.
But you have a brand new role at Purdue Fort Wayne. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so starting in August, I'll be joining the Department of Educational Leadership at the School of Education over at Purdue University Fort Wayne. And from a title standpoint, my title is officially a Clinical Associate Professor. For those that are not familiar with academia, what that basically means, the clinical part tells you which track I'm going down. So you either go publishing route, which is tenure, or you get involved in service. And since I can't keep my hands out of education, clinical seemed like the logical choice for me. And then the associate part has to do with the rank levels of the different professors. But looking forward to it. I'll be primarily teaching in the Masters of Educational Leadership program, but not pigeonholed to that at all. So looking forward to opportunities to work with pre-service, in-service, and then even looking at the potential of developing some new things for Purdue.
For people that aren't in education, what does pre-service and in-service mean?
So pre-service would be those college students who are going through that are probably 18 to 22 years old. It could be, though, an adult coming back through a transition program, but pre-service is simply a way to mean that they've not actually been in the teaching field yet versus working with in-service teachers, which are career educators that are coming back for additional training.
Mm-hmm. And before we went live with Mike, you were talking about kind of the phase of life you're in. You just married a son.
Yeah, so
tell us about your family.
So my wife Angie and I just celebrated our 29th anniversary, which seems crazy to me. Along that journey, we've had three children. Our oldest, Tyler, graduated from Indiana Wesleyan University a few years back. And interesting story there, Tyler's wife, Claire, those two went to school together when I was assistant superintendent of schools over at Twin Lakes, and they went to school together from grade one to grade five. Her dad, Claire's dad, Jim, drove a school bus for me. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy how kind of seeing God's hands and how he plots our paths and directs our steps. But Claire went to Ball State University to Teachers College to be one of those pre-service teachers. Mm-hmm. When she was there, she was aware, she wasn't aware. She put out on Facebook a post basically saying, does anybody know of a good home church? What she may not have known was that's where our family moved to after Twin Lakes. I became an assistant superintendent in the Muncie school system. Mm-hmm. And was, I think at that time, already working in Indiana Wesleyan, but still living there. But anyways, she put a post out. Tyler responds, the name of our home church was at the Bridge Community Church in Muncie, and that's what got them reconnected. So in March, we just had a big wedding. In addition to Tyler, we have two adult daughters who are in college. Abby is actually over at Purdue University Fort Wayne studying business. And Emily is an aspiring writer over at Bethel College, and she's starting her senior year this fall. So lots of stuff going on.
Yeah, so you've seen a real mix of higher ed and public and private. And
yeah, I actually, it's been an amazing career. I, I never dreamed I would be doing the kind of things I get to do. But my background was I started teaching in Noblesville, fifth grade teacher. As we get into a little bit of my personal story, again, referencing that God directs our paths, I don't think it was a coincidence that I started out in fifth grade, but I loved it. I loved everything about it. Mm-hmm. Went from that to becoming an elementary principal, and that's what took me to Twin Lakes initially. It was interesting because when I went there, that was my first principalship. And for those that are listening and maybe thinking about getting into administration, I jokingly tell people that don't be afraid to ask questions in your interviews, because one of the questions I should ask was, how many have come before me? Because I didn't ask that. And on my first day of employment as the new principal of Oakland Elementary School, I found out I was the fifth principal in 10 years. Mm. And it didn't take long to find out why that was the case. But that was my first immersive learning experience in school turnaround. And working in a very struggling culture, but because of the success I had there, within 3 years, I was asked to move up into the assistant superintendency, and I did that. That's probably my only career regret, because I really loved being an elementary principal, mm-hmm. but I had somehow talked myself into believing that if I passed on the opportunity to move into central office at that point, I wouldn't be able to stay at Twin Lakes. And that's very narrow-mindedness, because to think that I was going to be at Twin Lakes for the rest of my life now, looking back, was really silly. But that's where my thinking was at the time.
Right.
But I went from there to Muncie, and from Muncie I did about a 4 or 5 year stint before going into higher ed at Indiana Wesleyan University, and had the privilege of serving as their dean of their School of Education Leadership for several years. Mm-hmm. And during that period of time, I actually met the folks at Ambassador, which is where I just recently finished a 4 year term there as their Director of Education Innovation. Mm-hmm.
That's tremendous. So you've moved around in the levels of education. I'm curious, as you moved from the classroom to building principal to central office to higher ed and on, you know, there's that term new level, new devil. What were the new challenges as you managed bigger budgets, more people, more problems? You know, how did your leadership have to grow and change?
I believe absolutely doing everything you can to prepare yourself for the next position, but there's some things you can't prepare for.
Yeah.
I think that's why I always think of, it's an older book now, but there's a gentleman named Harry Wong that wrote a book called The First Days of School, mm-hmm. and he talks about in there, he gives new teachers permission to survive their first year of teaching. He should write a principal's version of that, because my first year of principalship was learning how to survive. I had in my head that principals basically walked around with a cup of coffee and just ensured everything was starting well.
Right.
I had no idea. You know, when you're responsible for 28 kids in your fifth grade classroom, that's one thing. When all of a sudden you're responsible for the lives of 534 kids in a K-5 building, and you begin to understand some of their stories and some of the dysfunction that they're coming up in and some of the chaos, and you visit some of those homes, it was something that I would love to say I was well prepared for. I think from a knowledge base I was, but certainly from an experiential base, it was one of the most challenging growing seasons for me. But I was able to leverage that in central office, and I've been able to leverage that also in higher ed as I've worked with preparing the next generation of school leaders. And even to some extent public policy, because one of the things I didn't share in that journey was when I was at Indiana Wesleyan, I unexpectedly got a call one day out of the blue asking me about whether or not I would consider an appointment from the governor to the State Board of Education. Mm-hmm. And that would be my second appointment. I'd done a smaller stint when Mitch Daniels was governor on the Professional Standards Advisory Board, mm-hmm. but they dissolved that board and moved all of its licensing function, which was what that board dealt with, was teacher licensure. They moved out all to the State Board anyways. But I tried to carry that with me into the policymaking side. And as we get into that today a little bit, about the state of education, I think it's something to be fun to discuss, which is what is happening. But mm-hmm. I tried to carry that in there with me and try to be a leader. But nothing can fully prepare you, but I've tried to approach every one of those opportunities as a learning experience.
Right. Well, let's get right into that.
Yeah.
Indiana is a bit of a unique state in terms of its policies and its reform movement, things like that. You've had an opportunity to see it at all kinds of levels. Can you give us, you know, maybe a snapshot or kind of a debrief of what's going on in Indiana?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I think Indiana's very innovative when it comes to education, and innovation's exciting. It's unique. It's messy. But I think, unfortunately, what has happened, the state of education, I share this with my education policy students at Purdue, The metaphor I would use is a Chinese finger. You remember those? Remember the old Chinese fingers we used to play with, where you'd put your finger in one end and I'd put my finger in the other end, and we would pull. So envision, if you can, a three-pronged Chinese finger, where in one prong you have practitioners' fingers, and another prong you've got policymakers, but you've got a third prong here, and that's special interest groups that represent a wide variety of constituency groups that have money and media, and they use it extremely well. When you put that all together, what happens is that you're getting poor policy that lacks practitioner input. And one of the challenges I've seen, and this is what you're seeing happening in K-12 education, and it's unfortunate, but as you try to innovate, you have to change policies to make a climate of innovation even possible. But the problem is that when you form policy, there's always three parts to this. There's a precept, there's the things that you believe that are going to bring about the desired change. Then there's the policy that gets created around those that precept. But then there's this third part that is, once you pass a policy, it's got to be put into practice. And the problem is that of those three Chinese fingers, everybody has a different level of pull within each one of those three domains. So everybody's competing on the precept side. It's pretty clear who controls the policy making side, and that's pretty much the policy makers. And oftentimes they do that without practitioner input. The problem is all of a sudden they pass a policy, we put it into practice, and what was intended to be innovative and actually bring about positive changes can be very problematic and troubling. And that's not to say that in Indiana all the policy changes have been negative. I think there has been some good things that come out of it, and I think if people are very objective, I can remember, Jason, when I came into the principalship, we didn't take testing serious at all. In fact, we would look at each other in the spring and think, is it time to put the I-STEP stickers on the permanent record cards?
Right.
We were not using it to be diagnostic with teaching. We were not using it to really shape individualized instruction, unless it was a kid going for special needs testing. So I think there has been some good things, particularly around how we've approached teaching and learning. On the negative side of it, though, there have been some policies that have been intended to encourage innovation in the field, and it's been done in a way that, and I'm speaking specifically about school choice, because I think that's the big one that as you look back, you're going to find was probably the real catalyst between some of the dysfunction now. But it was done in a way that when the special interest groups got involved, some of the folks who were lobbying for certain policy positions to allow school choice had a lot of cash behind those policymakers. And they oftentimes didn't want to hear what the practitioners had to say, because they would view the practitioners as obviously being automatically against school choice. And
right.
I don't know if that's the case, it might be, but I think what's happened is we've created an us versus them mentality in our state, and it's really unfortunate, because it's driven out of adult agendas, not student agendas.
Yeah, I work in a district that for a time one of the board members was an employee of a voucher school, of a school that took state money but had a whole different kind of set of rules and things like that. And this has been something that has been pretty controversial. I know the news broke about Indiana trying to recoup about $40 million.
Yeah.
Do you know much about that?
Yeah, that's the virtual school down in Indianapolis, and I do know a little bit about that, because when I was working with Ambassador, we did some work with Daleville. That was a small school district down in Delaware County that back in 2011, when they allowed virtuals to be created, it was required at that time that it had to be done as a charter. And in Indiana, for those that are listening that may or may not be aware, there's basically three bodies that can be an authorizer. You can be a local school district and be an authorizer, which surprises many people to find that out, but school districts can authorize a charter school. You can be a university, and then interesting enough, you can be the mayor's office in Indianapolis. In this case, what happened was you got a small school district, a K-12 school district down in Delaware County with about 800 students, 800 to 900 students, that can't afford full-time teachers for things like AP English, foreign language. So they were ripe to look at, is there a way that we could use online learning to broaden the accessibility of educational content to our students? Long story short, and this is what's interesting about what's not being reported, the state encouraged Daleville to get in as the authorizer on the school. Keep in mind, at the time that was being allowed, charters were just starting to take off. One of the things that's being underreported that sets in motion what just happened was that it was assumed by the General Assembly when they passed that the organizers, the school organizers, which are autonomous, they have their own school board. The authorizer is acting in proxy of the State Board of Education. it was always assumed that there'd be this wonderful relationship where data is openly shared. I can tell you, as a former member of the State Board of Education, that was not the case. And in fact, I know of at least one instance of a Ball State authorized charter school where the school refused to turn over its data and said, well, we're under no compulsion to do so. There's no law that requires it. So fast forward to Daleville, I think what people need to understand that isn't being widely reported was it actually took a change in the law that just happened about a year and a half to 2 years ago that requires the schools turn over their data to the authorizer. And so I know for a fact from speaking firsthand with Paul Garrison, who's Daleville superintendent, it was about August of last year that they got a chance to really dig into the data that they had not been able to get their hands on, which is really crazy because it means the authorizers are flying somewhat blind.
Right.
But as they begin to look at student enrollment and they saw the anomalies, that's what triggered a lot of this investigation you're hearing going on. What you're seeing now play out is that the way the charter law is written, the law does not require that the state board bring the school in front of it. It brings in the authorizer. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened at this past Wednesday's meeting, is they brought Daleville in to say, help us understand what's going on here. And so my heart goes out to Paul Garrison, but it is absolutely ridiculous what happened in any virtual. But it is unfortunate. Anytime you see adults basically take advantage of the law and use it. And I've raised this too. You're going to see this. If you follow me on social media, I've talked about this for 4 or 5 years. When I was at state board, I raised the issue then. There are two things that made that situation really bad. One was we do not have a definition in Indiana for virtual attendance. We don't. Mm. So in Indiana, if you're a virtual school, it's based on enrollment. So you're always 100% on your attendance rate, which must be lovely because brick and mortars don't get to say
right.
that.
Right.
The other thing you may find fascinating, this is what led to the situation that you're reading about in the paper, schools are financed based on an attendance count day. That's how brick and mortars are financed. So in other words, in September, your school is going to have a count day, and based on the number of seats, people sitting in seats on that day, number of students in seats on that day, that will drive the determination of the student tuition support payment to your school district for the next upteen months. So fast forward to this situation. Basically what's happening is nobody's checking to see if anybody's actually engaged. They're just looking at enrollment and they're collecting state tuition support. So I do hope they recover that $40 million. I'm really glad to see it. But more importantly, that is a classic example of what I was talking about, where we created a policy based on a precept that kids needed access to virtual education. And I believe they do. I think most educators believe they do. But it lacked practitioner input. And so policymakers, whether they'll ever accept any responsibility in this or not, I don't know. I doubt it. I'm not looking for them to step up and say, hey, we screwed up. But I'd like to see them go back and fix it, because we still have the same problem. So even if they can get the school to repay the $40 million, you still fundamentally have the same policy flaw, and it could happen again.
Right.
So.
And I'll be naive and say that maybe those things were all because it was sort of building the plane as you fly it. That there was a lot of unwritten trust, like, oh, you know, everybody be transparent, we'll iterate this, we'll make it better as we go. Yeah. And that's not what happened. It was maybe we're not sure we have everything in place correctly, we're going to close the books on this and try to fix it in-house, and then it turned into a big monster. Just on a side, how do people follow you on social media?
My Twitter handle is at Dr. Brad Oliver, and that's probably the best way. I've dialed back posting. I used to post a lot when I was a state board member. Yeah. I've dialed it back, but I still post on a few things. Virtual ed is one that still matters to me a lot, because you've got such a large growing segment of secondary students that are struggling, and brick and mortar is not a good fit for them. Mm-hmm. And my concern is when you see something like this happen, like what's happening down in Indianapolis at Indiana Virtual, my fear is that will that option be taken away from students because of the poor decisions and choices of a few adults? Mm-hmm. I hope not, because I see a pathway for virtual, particularly as a form of alternative education for mm-hmm. kids that are struggling. I don't think that'll happen. I think they will use this as an opportunity to learn from it, meaning the policymakers, and they already took some action this past spring based on some recommendations from the state board. In my opinion, they weren't strong enough. I can't tell you why they weren't more stronger than what they were, but I still don't know that they've addressed the underlying problem. But that's just one example. And you know, Jason, we could go down the line. Whether you look at ADF accountability, school choice, these all virtual education, they all suffer from the same thing. I assume good intent on the part of the policymakers. I really do. I tell my policy students this. I don't think lawmakers sit on the side of their bed in the morning and think about how to frustrate teachers.
Right.
I really don't think that's happening. I think there's good intention going on. But when you have the kind of situation I describe, where you've got basically policymakers, practitioners, and special interest groups all competing for power, there's no trust. And when there's no trust, you can't establish good policy because nobody's collaborating. And so that's our real, if you really want to get serious about the root problem, it's a trust issue right now. And we're not going to have good policy until you have practitioners and policymakers, and frankly, even some of the networked interest groups on the outside sitting together saying, what's in the best interest of kids? When that happens, you might start to see some good policy emerge.
Yeah, I think it was Stephen Covey that said and wrote, you lead at the speed of trust.
Exactly.
And so for folks listening that, you know, they're not hip deep in education policy all the time, really this is about the end product of what schools are doing for your kids. And this is about how your tax dollars are being used in Indiana. So we're kind of pulling back the curtain on this.
Yeah.
And it's pretty fascinating because even as a teacher, I knew that there was a count in the fall. I knew that, you know, I thought it was just generally on attendance. I didn't know it was on a single day. So what happens with kids that aren't there on that day?
They don't get included in the count until the next time that comes around. And it's interesting because this last legislative session, they just passed a law that's going to change it from one count day to two count days. So you get a second chance now, Jason. So if they're not there in September, and the third Friday of September, there's going to be an opportunity for them to be counted again in the spring. But that count, that official count day, sets in motion the number of students, because what happens is the state allocates a portion of money, let's say for East Allen County Schools, based on number of kids enrolled on that day. That's how you divide to get your average daily mandated number for each student. That's what determines the state tuition amount per student.
So let's dig into that a little bit, because that's interesting, because a school in my mind, a school that has great attendance is naturally going to have more money than a school that doesn't. So is this sort of like a punitive measure, or is this a motivational measure?
No, I think it's been around in Indiana for a long time. I think it's just one of the ways in which, when they're trying to find out systematically how do we evenly divide the pot up,
why can't the money just follow kids? Why can't a school just submit their attendance?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because going back to the virtual education, that's one of the things I just tweeted about recently, which was somebody was asking the question about how are we going to make sure this doesn't happen again? And it's real easy. Every student has a student test number now. There's no reason why you couldn't do an average daily attendance report and your district be reimbursed based on the number of souls that actually showed up to school that day. But that would require a change in the law. And for whatever reason, and I don't know the underlying reasons, they have not changed that law in forever. In fact, this last session where they went from one count day to two count days was the first time in a while as a part of the biennium budget process that I'm aware of that they've adjusted that at all. But you make a really great point. Some of the things we do, you just kind of scratch your head, because given modern technology and the ease of APIs between data systems, there are better ways we could do it where money could follow. And philosophically, yeah, I have no problem with that. I really do believe that. And in fact, if school choice actually truly was a school choice and it wasn't pitting different types of schools against different types of schools, and you had a true level playing field, mm-hmm. I think you would hear less frustration being voiced about the idea behind school choice. Because I think most people believe that parents should have some choice in it, but the way that they do it is punitive when you look at it to public school districts because of the way that they've designed the financing side of it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an urban district and you're struggling with attendance and that day hits, you are getting funded for maybe 80% of the kids you're actually servicing.
Yep.
Whereas if you're a four-star school, so to speak, and you got all your kids there that day, you're getting all the money.
Yeah. Well, it's not uncommon. I don't know how, you know, I don't know your school district. I know in my school district, especially as a principal, I did everything I could to try and make sure everybody showed up on that day, because it was a really important day.
Yeah.
It was like, we need everybody here. Everybody show up. It's count day. That's what's going on, because based on whatever that number comes back that day, it has implications for the next 18 months in your school district.
Yeah, and I misspoke earlier. A charter school is a full school. And vouchers are a whole nother thing. Can we talk about that? Explain vouchers to us.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, and that's a really good point too, because a lot of people think charter schools are private schools, and they're not. They're public schools. Mm-hmm. All that's happened in the charter is that the state board has basically handed its authority of oversight over to an authorizer, an independent authorizer. And a voucher system, a voucher is exactly what it sounds like. What Indiana did was is it created the ability think of it as a scholarship. In fact, that's what Indiana has called its voucher program. It's the Indiana Choice Scholarship. So the idea is that if we know what the ADM is per student in your district, and they can determine that based on what we've been talking about, basically what it allows for is that you can take your child, a parent can take their child to a private school if they so choose, that has basically that they basically want their child to attend, and they will cover that tuition amount not to exceed, and I forget what the cap is, I think it's something like 90% or 80%, but there's a not to exceed amount on it, but that number is such that typically it covers it. The real impact that you're describing is probably the biggest thing that from a public education side, it's a loss of money away from the district. Mm-hmm. So, and if you're Fort Wayne Community Schools and you're losing, and I'm just throwing some numbers out, I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, but let's say you're losing 300 students, and each one of those students represents about $6,500 in state tuition support per year to your district. I mean, you can do the math on that. Take 300 times 6,500. You're talking a sizable chunk of money. The problem on the operation side is you don't lose those kids out of the same classroom. Right. You're losing that 300 from across the district. So if 300 kids leave Fort Wayne Community Schools, I'm pretty sure that Wendy Robinson is still going to need the same number of teachers, the same number of janitors, the same number of classrooms, and there might be a kid or two less in the class, but the operational cost didn't drop when those kids went out, but the revenue line dropped significantly. And that's what contributes to that kind of problem that you're seeing about, coupled with the fact that, and again, I can't explain why other than you got special interest groups, the General Assembly in Indiana continues to ramp up what that voucher amount can be, and they did that just last year as well. And so they'll argue different reasons why they're going down that path, but what they've not acknowledged is that when you take the loss of student tuition support because of the voucher, and you couple that with the fact that you've got other school funds that rely on local property taxes that are now capped locally because of legislation we did years ago under Governor Daniels, and we call that the circuit breaker, which basically puts a cap on how much you can actually raise locally, it really puts the whammy on a lot of school districts. And, you know, not just urban districts, but if you talk to rural districts, they're getting hurt too. And the state policymakers will say, well, you know, you can go pass a local referendum. You can locally decide if you want to pass and raise more property taxes and exceed that circuit breaker and make up for the losses. But you know this as well as I do. In most communities, only about 27% of the population in that community actually use the services of a school.
Right.
That leaves a large percentage of the general population that you have to sell on let me raise your taxes for a service you're not even using. Now, some are great and they understand the link between education and economic growth, and so they'll vote for those things. But you saw just this last election in May, we had some local area school districts that were not successful or school systems that were not successful in passing the referendum, and it largely goes back to when you look at the populace who's going out to vote, they're going to think about that. Do I really want to raise my taxes? And so it's put them in a really put school leaders and particularly superintendents in a very challenging place in their school boards.
And vouchers are funded differently, aren't they? If that kid goes from just here, an example in Fort Wayne, I'll give you an example, would be like, he goes from Harris Elementary, where they have a lovely lady teaching phys ed that I get to see every day, to Holy Cross Lutheran on a voucher.
Yeah.
And the state pays differently for that student going to Harris, right? $6,500, or if there's special needs, more to the voucher amount.
So what happens is it's the same pool of money, but what happens is rather than before it ever gets to your school district, because that voucher has been accepted, it's already been pulled off and steered away. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a sitting school superintendent, I can, and I know that student's over at that Lutheran school, mm-hmm. I can actually see that loss. I can actually see that drop, because even if my enrollment should be X, and I have this many students, whoops, I'm sorry, pounded on your desk there. even if I know what my number should be of students living in my district, I can see how many students from my district are going outside the district. But the, what happens is it impacts me because that money is based on where the child lives. And going back to virtual education, I know for a fact that's an area that hurt Fort Wayne quite a bit, because if you assume that those 300 students we were talking earlier about, and it was fictitiously, but let's say it's 300 students from Fort Wayne and they go to a virtual school, Fort Wayne Community Schools is still losing that money even if they go to 7 different virtuals. Right. So it's how it has more to do with how they're dividing up the pot. And so what happens is, and this is the part everybody can understand, if I have a pot of money and you're siphoning off a large chunk of that off the top, mm-hmm. because kids are exercising their right to vouchers, I've now got to operate the same size school district with a smaller pot.
Right. And then you got to make hard decisions.
And you're seeing
bus services.
Absolutely.
Do we offer these kind of things? And I'm not picking on Holy Cross. I just thought of it because yep. I drove by it on the way here, stopping at Old Crown, which is right near, which is a coffee yeah. roaster. And it's a great school. But my kids have gone from private to public, and we've seen both. I've taught in private. I've taught in public. And I think it, maybe you speak to this, maybe not, I'm not sure. But I think when private schools began accepting public money, it started to muddy their mission.
Yeah, I think it's I'll make it an interesting statement. I hope this doesn't happen, but I'm one of these folks that looks at education and I kind of forecast what I think is going to happen. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. If you go back and look at how we got to where we're at, when Mitch Daniels was governor and Tony Bennett was our state superintendent, when they passed that law that created the voucher system, if you actually look at the language of the statute, it's very small. It's about a paragraph. Mm-hmm. And it basically says, we direct the State Board of Education to adopt administrative rules on how to regulate a choice scholarship program. Now, that wasn't, just so you're tracking with me, that was not unintentional. In other words, rather than scripting out all the rules by which vouchers could happen in a statute, mm-hmm. they deferred it to the state board. Well, why would they do that? Because you have an 11-member board. One of those members is the state superintendent, and the other 10 are appointed by the governor. It is much easier to write administrative rule at the state board, because basically I have to alert the public that I'm going to write rule. I have to have a 45-day public comment period, and then we can adopt whatever we want to adopt. It doesn't have to go back to the General Assembly. Right. That's what they did with the voucher program. Now, why do I bring that up? Because you asked me about the private schools. If there's ever a change in the governorship, let's say we go from a Republican governor to a Democratic governor and we replace the entire school board, overnight, that new State Board of Education could change the rules and they could put conditions on the voucher that makes it absolutely intolerable for that private Christian school to continue to receive that money.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's the concern I have, because in the interim since that period that we created that pathway, we've seen a huge increase in private schools. And Fort Wayne is interesting because a good friend of mine who's down at Ball State now, Dr. Jamie Garlow, did her doctoral dissertation on this, and she found that 25% of all the vouchers actually emanate out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Mm. And it's not lost on us that that's because we're home to a large Lutheran group and a large Catholic group that have both figured out how to market the voucher very well to grow their schools. And if I were in their shoes, I would be trying to do that. You would be trying to do that. The danger is that if that changes and all of a sudden it's no longer compatible, like there's some condition put on there, and you're seeing this at the state level. We just had a situation at Roncalli High School, I think, down in Indianapolis that said we're going to fire a school leader because of a lesbian arrangement. She's married to, mm-hmm. to a female. There's now raising this question, if you receive a voucher, should you be allowed to discriminate in employment practices on the basis of sexual orientation? Now, without getting us buried in the weeds, here's the concern. If that changes, and let's say the school board puts a condition on it, says that you can only accept a voucher if you include language that protects non-discriminatory hiring practices, and let's say that Lutheran school says, well, we're not going to do that, that we feel that violates our moral code, it violates our biblical code, the same pathway that took them from, 100 students in school to 1,000 students in school is going to be disrupted overnight. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but it is interesting. You raise a very interesting dynamic about that, because once you go down that path as a private school and you start accepting public mm-hmm. dollars, you are now beholden to the person who gives it to you. And you're going to have to decide at some point, am I going to play by their rules, or are we going to stay anchored in our mission? And I don't know how that's all going to shake itself out. It's an interesting question.
Well, I know of two Baptist-based schools, one in Auburn and one of Fort Wayne, that my kids had gone to before going to public school, and they were both formed in 1973, yeah. self-funded. And sort of that libertarian heart of me liked the fact that it was, you know what, that's a community that came together on their own. Yep. They decided they wanted to set the script for what school looks like and, yeah. and those kind of things, which I think give them a really a strong and appealing to that community, you know, place and you know, kind of a foundational place in that community. When you take public money, in my opinion, it really muddies that because I think it can set you adrift and off mission. All of a sudden, you're working within the grant guidelines, so to speak. You know, nonprofits deal with this. Yeah. Like, well, we got this big grant, and now 40% of our time are off mission of what we were originally here to do.
Right.
And the other part is, you know, what happens when? I mean, let's go from the not the hiring practice side, but the student side. What if a group of voucher students at a school that's, you know, like a kind of a traditional Christian private school, Catholic, Lutheran, Baptist, whatever, decide they want to have a Wicca group?
Right.
You know, and well, there's FCA. Why can't we have a Wicca group?
Yep.
And then it becomes the lawsuit. It becomes the media circus. It becomes the thing. And now you, as a school and as an organization, now you've got parents are going to bail because, you know, well, that's not what we signed up for.
Yep.
And it becomes a whole thing. So I like to have stronger lines in those
yeah.
things.
You raise a good point. And, you know, I one of the things I've been blessed to do, I work with not just public schools. I work with a lot of private mm-hmm. schools, parochial schools, and I appreciate the work that they do. So if they're listening to this, I don't want them to go, wow, he works with us, and he sounds like he's not pro-school choice. I'm pro-student, and that's here's right. the thing. I appreciate the fact that from a mission standpoint, that they've been able to leverage school choice to help introduce many students, some into a relationship with Christ, which as a fellow believer, I think that's amazing. But here's the reality of it. We need to focus more on making sure that we've got solid educators that are using their influence to effectively impact every student.
Right.
And my bigger concern is what's happened is that school choice has done is it because it's pitted this us versus them mentality. We have forgotten that we're all dealing with similar students with similar issues that all need the nurturing impact of a caring adult in their life. And my hope is that as this stuff plays itself out in the political theater arena of Indianapolis, in the nuts and bolts of classrooms here, even in Fort Wayne in Northeast Indiana, I hope we'll get back to focusing on what can we do to make sure that teachers are in a good mindset. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I'm very concerned about right now is that we have been so focused on how to teach our students and what to teach them. We got a number of teachers that find themselves in a career moment where they're asking themselves, why am I doing this? And when we're not transformational and you become transactional, it's really hard to impact a student life because you're just trying to survive. You're just trying to get through your day and get out of there.
You're punching out commodity.
Absolutely.
And I totally know what you're talking about. If you follow my Instagram during the school year, you know, I always have a quote that kind of sets the day and the mindset, things I talk to kids about. And I might dedicate up to 15% of my time having conversation with them about their mindset, about their transformation and their growth. And the school I teach at is pretty unique. It's very rural. For a long time, it was very rural and white. And then the boundaries changed. And it you know, included a lot more as a school closed. It included a lot more Southeast Fort Wayne, which is got a different makeup than, you know, these two small towns that, you know, big FFA group, things like that. And so that blending occurred and everybody, you know, sort of learned to get along and everything is okay and it was fine. And then we got another group of Burmese Muslim families that have moved to the southeast side of town and they've been added. And so now we've, you know, the blend there is incredibly diverse for a school that, you know, seeing it on the outside, you wouldn't think. And we're also the ED, the emotionally disabled school for the district.
Yeah.
And so you learn, you know, as a teacher, I love it because I just love the variety. Like, you know, well, today's the day that we're not pushing the button. You know,
right.
Today's that day. You know, you get to have a lot of fun, but you know, pretty openly homosexual students, and it's a pretty fun blend. And one of the things I enjoy is building relationships with kids, especially like the outsider kids, and just so they know that, like, hey, you and I, you know, as one of my interns this year was very openly gay, very Wiccan, you know, just kind of a unusual kid, great ideas, great kid, had a lot of trauma in life. that we, you know, she would just bring up, and we're like, well, okay, I guess we're talking about that today. But just having an opportunity for kids to know that somebody like me, with my beliefs and the things that, that I hold dear, just care about them. Like, you know, we're not in the place where, you know, I need to hit you with apologetics about,
right,
you know, the breakdown of what I view God and the universe as being.
Right.
But just knowing somebody cares. And, you know, one of my toughest students all year gave me a great card at the end of the year. It had a big impact on me. It was just a thank you card. I mean, yeah. This person gave me grief daily. And as a teacher, you got to be able to roll with that. You might have a kid that's going to give you grief daily, and you're going to be in the furnace. You're going to be in the forge, yeah, of who you are and all that stuff. And so mindset is huge, and I'm glad you brought that up. What would you say to teachers that, say, the beginning teacher you talked about survived the first year versus what about that person that's in 15 years and they know they can go make a lot more money doing other things, and they're at that place. Like, they're just like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. This isn't about transforming lives. We're about testing. We're about, you know, pushing this agenda. I don't know if I signed up for this 15 years ago, because the state's changed a lot.
This is an area that, for the last few years anyways, I've been especially focused in, particularly as the Director of Education Innovation Ambassador, because we became very concerned. We could see, even back at the time when I was working with them, when I was at Indiana Wesleyan, we could see a growing number of teachers leaving the profession. At the same time, too, we were looking at retention rates of first and second year teachers that were dropping under 50%, which is just insane, and I don't think that number has improved at all. I think what's even sadder, is there are fewer students actually choosing to go into the profession. But whatever camp that they're in, whether they're the veteran teacher, the beginning teacher, it comes back to clarifying, why did you get into this to begin with? And I don't know about you, but I know that even though I can articulate my why, I have to surround myself with like-minded people that constantly remind me, yeah, this is why I'm getting up and going back into the classroom today. We have to have that kind of an opportunity to connect. And I mentioned to you that education is very personal to me, and I wanted to share this with you briefly. When I was 12 years old and I was in the sixth grade, my father became very ill. He was misdiagnosed. He had hyperthyroidism that went undiagnosed. It was masking itself as other things. They were treating it psychotropically with medication. He gets to the Cleveland Clinic. They destroyed the thyroid gland. But now they got a new problem, because normally that's not a super difficult operation. You destroy the thyroid gland, and then you put the patient on a synthetic thyroxine to control their chemistry level. But my dad got to that stage and was still taking 13 psychotropic medications that had been given to him over a two-year period to try and control symptoms instead of dealing with the root problem.
And you don't just drop those, do you?
You don't. And unfortunately for him, in the spring of 1982, in February of 1982, Dad had a psychotic episode, and he ended up taking his own life. 12 years of age, my world is devastated. Thank goodness it was a teacher who stepped in. And here's what's amazing about this. It wasn't even one of my current sixth grade teachers. It was my former fifth grade teacher, Bob Smallwood, who'd had me the year before. And I can remember walking out the back of the church at the funeral when they were wheeling my dad's casket out and the family followed. I remember Bob Smallwood standing at the back of that church waiting for me and putting his hands on me and saying, "You're going to be okay." That man would write me for the next year. We literally, in 3 days' time, if you can imagine this, grew up around Wheeling, West Virginia. My older brother, who was like 24, married, had a small child, he's living in Huntington. My mom and dad rented an old farmhouse from a coal mining company. So it wasn't like we had to sell a house. And mom never went beyond high school education. So all of a sudden, my 24-year-old brother's inheriting his mother and basically four younger siblings that are moving into his 14x70 trailer in Huntington, West Virginia. It was chaotic. That all happened in a three-day period. I didn't think I was going to be okay. Yet here was a fifth grade teacher, and I'm so glad that in 1982, Bob Smallwood wasn't inundated every day worrying about his teacher effectiveness rating or what his A to F score was going to be or how many kids was going to pass the test. The only thing Bob Smallwood was worried about was Brad Oliver. And he wanted to make sure and I think it was just because there's some part of everybody that goes into teaching, I think we all have this empathy for kids to want to contribute to their ability to become whatever God intended for them to become. I'm so glad he's like that. That was a gentleman that in my mind was clear in his why. I've tried to bring that back into some of this, and there's different ways it can happen. And there's some really good resources out there right now that are emerging. One locally here that I'm excited about is Region 8 has gotten involved with Brenda Jank, who runs the Run Hard, Rest Well, just to help start working with professional educators about the importance of resting, of really being able to retreat and find time to say, why am I doing to recharge your batteries? Because here's the reality. If you're not doing that, there's one of two teachers in the classroom. You're either highly transactional where you're just trying to get through the day, punch it out, and you're probably the teacher's got the plaque on the wall that says the three reasons I went into teaching were June, July, and August. It's funny, but it's symptomatic of there are some people that are just basically holding on for those 3 months. As soon as they're back in August, they're just holding on for fall break. But then you've got other teachers, and this is where I want to encourage those who are listening, and this is where I hope, in going back to Purdue, I can help contribute to new programs and things that are emerging where we can get into some discussion around this. It is still an incredible profession. Name me another profession where we get to impact lives. I mean, really impact a child's lives. And here's the greatest news for everybody's listening. We've talked a lot about policy today. We've talked about virtuals and school choice and vouchers. We don't necessarily control that. Many times as practitioners, we're on the receiving end of whatever Indianapolis thinks of at the State House, and we do our best to implement it. But none of that in any way ever changed or will ever change the capacity of a teacher to impact a child. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to negate it. It only negates itself if we allow it to, because we became transactional. So my point to you is this: transformation is the outgrowth on being clear on your why. It's finding fulfillment, knowing that I got into this because I believe that there's a lot of ways I can use my influence in life, but I'm going to use it to help make a difference in this child's life. And who knows, you may or may not be aware of the impact you've had. It may be years later. I've still got students come back to me. I don't recognize them anymore because they were 12 years old when I had them, and they're 35, 36 right. now, and they've got 12-year-olds. But it's pretty amazing to step back and think, wow, I got to be a small part in that process. But that's where my hope is. I hope we can get back to that, and I think that's what brings excitement into teaching. And joy and passion is when you realize the impact that you helped contribute to. And so for all those teachers that may be listening, getting ready to come back, I hope they're starting to get fired up about the next school year. Yeah. I hope they're fired up in the sense of, I wonder who God will send me this year that I get to make a difference in. And I love what you said, too. You know, a lot of people don't know this, I'm an ordained minister, too. And I thought I was going to go into youth ministry, but I realized I was only going to get to see the kids on Saturday night and Sunday. So by going into teaching, I decided to make that kind of my ministry pathway, and I never regretted it. And like you said, I never felt like I had to stand up on a tabletop and preach openly, and nor would I. I don't know who said it. It was one of the saints that said, preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words. Right. it's great. But, you know, there was a study done several years ago, and I don't know if the number is still true, but somebody at Ball State did a study years back, probably about 12, 15 years ago. And it was one of these surveys that they put out. They did a sample survey. And what they determined was about 68% of teachers in public education identify themselves as faith-based. Mm-hmm. Think about that. That's amazing. 70% of the adults that our kids in our state are going to have interactions with should be anchored in something deeper, that even when chaos is happening around them, they're not getting sucked up into the chaos, but they're able to navigate themselves through it. So I still think it's the greatest profession in the world. Obviously, I'm pretty passionate about it. So probably a good thing I'm going to Purdue, since the new tagline at Purdue University Fort Wayne is education with purpose.
Right.
Fits me perfectly. Purpose and passion.
Wow, that's tremendous. And, you know, thanks for sharing that story. I mean, that's a tough thing to walk through. And it's interesting that you share that story here in Remedy Live Studio, because, you know, they're helping kids in a lot of those same situations, you know, with their Soul Medic, chat rooms and things like that. You know, I think those stories, although anecdotally encouraging, are sometimes hard to quantify for people that are making policy that are about accountability and data and things like that. Is there some way to bridge that gap? You know, I'm thinking of state senators, even one in particular, that would, although be grateful to hear that story, his similar faith background, etc., comes from this business background of, mm-hmm. you know, we've got to make the balance sheet square, and we've got to, you know, coming from that background of somebody that's always got to make payroll and things like that. How do you square that circle? You know, how do you, I don't know if there's an answer to that, but I always think about that, like, to because what it sounds like when you're an educator and you feel like you're talking to somebody that's making the policy decision, you're trying to share these stories, you know, it doesn't feel like it's resonating.
Yeah.
You know, how do you square that circle?
Well, one of the things I've been doing and encouraging my graduate students is you can get a lot done over a cup of coffee. And what I mean by that is this. We are not going to solve this tension, this Chinese finger tension between all these groups through late night Twitter media storms. That isn't with a hashtag. That isn't going to – lawmakers are not sitting in Indianapolis freaked out because teachers are up late at night all retweeting the same thing and feeling good because they got their anger out.
Right.
We are not going to solve it by policymakers doing these photo ops where they walk through a school and they listen to the stories and take the pictures. The way that you have to build trust is there has to be a way that we can engage in dialogue where I'm willing to put my core assumptions on the table and you're willing to put your core assumptions on the table and we're willing to forge a shared set of new core assumptions on which we can move forward in a relationship together. I don't know how that's going to happen unless we start getting at this problem from more of a relational approach. The good news is this. I used to think that there was not a willingness on some of the Republican, and I shouldn't make it Republican or Democrat, but our two houses, our Senate and our House, are largely controlled by a Republican majority. Mm-hmm. And as a registered Republican myself, I thought, you know, I could make a difference in this. So I went to the state board. I really thought, I'm going to be able to make a difference in this. Well, boy, did I get my lunch handed to me. But here's what I am encouraged about. That was in 2012, 2013 when I was asked to step onto the state board, and I'm telling you, there I would have been doing good to get one of those people to come out and meaningfully sit and have a conversation. Mm-hmm. They are now at least at a position where many of them are becoming more aware something is wrong. Remember, they went into this with good intent, but they're looking at these things, and even they're looking at the evidence, and they're going, this isn't working. We thought this was going to help us in 11, 12. When we passed putting students first in 2013, it was supposed to make all this difference. It's 2019. We're not better than we were. In some cases, we're worse off than we were. In fact, the biggest fallout of this is we got fewer people wanting to go into teaching. And yes. So I think I say that to encourage those who are listening to say, I think you're going to find local lawmakers, and because most of our local lawmakers here are of the Republican Party. There's a few Democrats in the area, but most of them are largely of that party. I do think you'll find a greater receptiveness of them to sit down and engage and talk. I don't think walking them through your school is the answer, but I think if you can find a way to have a meaningful conversation, not try to cover every topic, but just start at a basic level. And I tell you the biggest one, I would hope that if there was an opportunity to go grab coffee with a lawmaker, you need to help them start understanding what's happening with this increase in socio-emotional trauma in the classroom.
Yeah.
Because the mental health right now of our students is a crisis. And the second crisis I see next to it is teacher mental health. Mm-hmm. It is an issue. And you only have to look at this last legislative session. They passed a school safety bill. And one of the things I was really sad to see was Dr. McCormick had asked for an increase in mental health funding. They didn't do that. They basically expanded a cap on a grant that has existed to allow for mental health resources, which is great. But all that's going to do is put more people competing for the same scarce amount of money in that grant. It's not the same thing as a state saying, oh my gosh, this is a crisis. We need to respond. What resources do you need at a school level to counteract the fact that we've got kids coming to us for school whose parents are caught up in opioid abuse, whose homes are, I don't even like to use the word dysfunctional. It is just chaos. That's the better word. It is just chaotic.
Dysfunction at least implies that there's function.
There is no functioning.
There's not even a bad process functioning.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I think it's going to take those kind of conversations where we're careful on what we choose to pick and build the relational trust with them so that they see that, hey, this is not just me trying to reassert talking points that were handed to me by either the ISTA or by some other group, but this is me talking from the heart on why this matters and where we're having impact and what's working against us to have that impact. If we can get enough of that going, you know, to quote one of my favorite thought leaders in education is a guy named Sir Ken Robinson.
Oh, yeah.
And Sir Ken would say, if you can get enough people moving in that direction, you've started a movement. And so I'll kick this off, Jason, here. I want to start the cup of coffee movement. I always tell people, cup of coffee will get you 20 minutes with me. But I'm finding sitting down with people and getting to know their stories. I think you and I consider ourselves pretty good friends. And I would argue that the reason we are as we've gotten to know each other's story over the last four or five years that we've known each other. And the more we learn about each other's story, I would argue that actually makes our bond even deeper, not weaker. And so if something would come up between us that, for whatever reason, God forbid, might create potential conflict, if we've made those relational investments and I know you, sitting down to have coffee to talk about that disagreement isn't the same thing as I don't know you, so I just want to win the argument.
Right.
Totally different scenarios.
And social media exacerbates that for sure.
Absolutely.
And, you know, something that I've learned in teaching is you can only speak as deeply as your relationship goes with a person.
Yep.
And you got to invest in people if you want them to listen to you, for sure. I was thinking about this the other day. I kind of miss, this is going to sound really odd, I miss old liberals. I know this is probably going to trigger people. I'm sorry. But what I'm talking about
trigger
is...
Trigger warning.
When I think about... I was raised in a Democrat home, and you know, the extended family was that way, and this strain of liberalism where it was like, you know, they sort of like, let's have these reasonable conversations about stuff that matter. And yeah. I tell people this all the time, like, you get out of the social media world of all this division, because when you really talk to your neighbors who are very different from you, they probably are really about the same stuff. Like, what do they want? They want better schools. They want to be safe.
Right.
They want to have opportunity. You know, they want freedom. And maybe, and this always gets weird, but maybe they enjoy a certain amendment of freedom more than you do. And you've got a different amendment of freedom. You know, maybe they like the first and you like the second, or I don't know.
Yeah.
But it, understand the spirit, you know, for the listener that I'm talking about. I'm talking about, like, there was a time in American politics, even at the national level, when, you know, like Ron Reagan and Tip O'Neill and those people would go for drinks afterwards.
Yeah.
They'd battle it out. Just battle it out. And then they go for drinks. And it reminded me of the sheepdog and the coyote cartoon. They punch in, battle it out, punch out. It wasn't animosity. They weren't throwing shots over Twitter. You know, and it was, to me, that was about a focus of, like, building a better America, community, things like that. Like, I could disagree with you. We're fairly on the same track. You know, this idea of, like, let's improve schools together. Yeah. Like, that spirit of trust. And I'm hoping that we swing back into that.
You know? I do too, but I you mentioned social media, and I think social media has made it, taken it out of a spirit of civility and made it very personal. Mm-hmm. I mean, we attack people in 140 characters, and it's sad because even while I may like some of the policies associated with the current person who holds the White House, when our president tweets, I cringe. I absolutely cringe. He'll tag something and have to say, you're a loser. And yet at the same time, the first lady's out pushing a cyberbullying campaign.
Right.
And again, not to bash on him, but I see us do this even in local education policy. I see these 140 character, and I think now it's 280 character, which I don't think helped us. Yeah. We've doubled the character count that you can tweet. And people write these real stinging things that they would never say to somebody sitting across the table from them. But late at night in a social media environment, I'll put it out there and boom. And I think that has been – that's an element that exists now that didn't exist in the days when we talk about the good old days of Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill sitting down and hashing it out. Good statesmanship was always about us coming together and doing three things. One was always assuming good intent of the person sitting across from us. Mm-hmm. Two, making very good decisions about how I'm going to respond, not react, but respond to what's being said to me. And then third, and this is probably what we've lost more, is evaluating our ability to say, could I have done something better in that conversation? What could I do to make this better so that the next time we come together, we continue to build this thing? And we have lost that, and I share that with you, Jason. I hope we get back to that, because I know when I was at State Board, I had some colleagues on the other side of the political ideological spectrum. Gordon Henry, who just went off the board. I consider Gordon one of my best friends. We agree on nothing on the political landscape. And if Gordon ever would ever happen to hear this, Gordon, you still owe me a dinner. But from the standpoint of being able to collaborate with him on behalf of students, we had no problem with that. We could go at it and really try to dig into an issue because it wasn't personal. And the reason it wasn't personal was I knew his story, he knew my story, And that's, our stories are powerful. And I don't know if, I think it was Peter Tsang that wrote the book, The Fifth Discipline, where he first introduced the idea of organizations as learning organizations. But he makes the statement that all we ever know of a person are the stories they tell. That is so true. And I watch people duking it out on social media, and they're slinging mud back and forth each other, and you know that they don't even know each other.
Right.
They don't know. I've had people sling mud at me, and I'm going, but you don't even know me.
Right. Absolutely.
I'm a great guy. I'm a teddy bear. It's amazing.
So I'm going to throw a challenge out for everybody listening that if somebody goes with an ad hominem attack on you, they just attack you. I would say reach out with a, let's have a cup of coffee. And if they're not local, absolutely, you can do that over FaceTime.
Yep.
How weird would that be? We start that movement up.
Yeah.
And just some civility. And you you and him having a podcast together called The Odd Couple, I think, would just, let's go. The Odd Couple, like with the old music from da-da-da-da, you know. And and talk about education and policy from these two perspectives would be great.
Let me add one thing to your idea, because I think you're onto something great here. But if you get together for that cup of coffee, don't go into the cup of coffee as trying to win your argument. That's not the purpose of the cup of coffee. Yeah. Your goal in that should be to listen, is to drink the coffee and listen. Every time you feel like you're going to speak, take a sip, put the cup back down. We need to do a better job. There's a verse of scripture that's always served me well. It says, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to get angry. We would be very wise to heed the words of James when he says to do just that. Be slow to speak, quick to listen, slow to get angry. If we would do that more, there's a chance we'd get our story out, we'd build that relational trust, and we would end up in a better place with better policy. And I guarantee it, once the policy starts getting right, practice will flourish. It's not going to happen right now when there's this disconnect. And the disconnect is not because we don't know how to teach, and it isn't because we don't know how to create policy. Our problems are relational, and we're struggling to understand how do two people who with very different assumptions about how the world should move, how do we live in a shared time, shared space, shared resources, and do something on behalf of students. So that's my hope.
Well, that sounds tremendous. I mean, we probably couldn't get away with having beer together, but
that's your beverage of choice.
That might be for later, but that whole idea of also to even add a thought from stoicism, which is I'm not emotionally invested in my ideas, because if I get new information and I'm wrong, I should be able to unload it.
Yeah.
I should be able to improve my idea.
Yep.
And I think that's where people get tied up. They get really emotionally connected, like their idea is them.
Yep.
Their ideology is them. And that's why I feel very comfortable. I mean, if you're not comfortable being argued with, don't teach.
Yeah.
And you'll be tested.
Yep.
And I was that kid. I tested teachers all the time.
Yep.
And I pressure test people. And
yeah.
I pressure test friends. I want to see what they're made of. And you squeeze a sponge, you see what comes out.
Yep.
So, what if you're an educator and you're interested in getting connected with Purdue's Ed Leadership Program? What should they do?
So, there's a couple things. The easiest one would obviously be go to the website pfw.edu. You'll be able to click right in through to the School of Education. There are actually a number of master's programs for in-service teachers that want to come back. I just happen to be teaching the one that's in Ed Leadership, which is specifically the one that's approved by NELP, which is the National Education Leadership group that has accredited that program, so that when you're done, you're ready to sit for your principal licensure test. And I'm excited about being a part of that, because obviously I think school leadership and think effective schools research shows this. The principal is still the hinge pin in the culture. I mean, they set the tempo, they set the cadence. So if you're interested in that, that's the quickest way. If you're sitting on the fence and you're not sure yet, reach out to the Continuous Studies office. I've had a number of students the last couple of years who've just sat in and take my policy class. It's always fun on the first day there. I say, this is called education policy, but it's also how does sausage get made? It's very messy, very ugly. And they leave almost terrified, like, I'm not sure I wanted to know all that. But I think they walk away going, wow, I actually have a better understanding of why we're in the situation we're in. So if you're sitting on the fence, you're not sure if you want to go into it, go through Katia's Taste, because if you take a class or two, you can always apply it when you make formal, you know, application to the program. You can do it there. There are other programs that are going to be emerging, and there are a number of their programs. And I as the newest member of the School of Education faculty, I probably can't do justice but to every program that's over there. But I think the easiest way is to just reach out. And if I can be of help, obviously, whether you reach out through Twitter or you want to reach out directly to me, my email address at Purdue is oliverb@pfw.edu. So if you wanted to even shoot me an email, I'm happy to reach out. If you're thinking about continuing studies, Angie Williams is a good contact. Wiley Sirk is the director of the Educational Leadership Program. If you're interested in something outside of ed leadership, Isabel Nunez is over the School of Education, and that entire team over there is just phenomenal. I'm very excited to be joining that faculty. I'm looking forward to great things, because I just sat, and don't even start till August. I just had a meeting with them a couple weeks ago, and they were meeting trying to figure out how can they help teachers in response to this new House Enrolled Act that's going to require 15 points, professional growth points, in an externship or something career related. Yeah, and without getting us buried in the weeds, I raised that only to say I was moved by the passion I heard around the table of faculty wanting to be responsive to what's being enacted that's going to affect the practitioner. So I'm excited to be joining a team like that that's thinking forward about what can we offer. And the other thing I would love to say to those that are listening to the podcast, if you have ideas, and Jason, even, I know you're full of ideas, so that's why I always love hanging out with you for lunch or coffee. What do you need? What do you need to be successful? Because at our best, I really think at our best, speaking as a member of that faculty of the School of Education, we should be laying the groundwork to bring to you the knowledge and information and creating the experiences you need that are going to best empower you to make a difference. Because at the end of the day, what matters to me is not so much what your final letter grade is or your effectiveness rating. I'm worried about the impact of that student. So if you tell me that you're dealing with a social-emotional crisis, more kids in trauma than you've ever dealt with, and you need help on that front, I'm going to move to figure out how do we get that to you, because that's really, I think, the role of higher ed at this juncture where we're at in education is what can we do to help be supportive, and the word I like to use is be responsive. I don't want to do anything to anybody. I want to do something with them that's going to cause them to say, I was better because of the interaction I had with Dr. Oliver over at Purdue and with the other faculty members over there.
And just to clarify, you had been teaching an adjunct course in policy
at
the graduate level, and now you're leaving Ambassador Enterprises, which is a nonprofit, and doing a lot of things. You had a leadership role there, and you're pivoting over to Purdue full-time.
Yeah, it was really interesting because I've been one of those guys that's never been satisfied to stay and do one thing for forever. I just get too many things in my head I want to do, and I'm looking for the platform, the growth platform that's going to let me do that. But I was in higher ed at Indiana Wesleyan for several years and enjoyed it. I was the dean of their School of Education. I only left it because Ambassador offered me the ability to work down at the Summit campus and bringing like-minded partners together to do some pretty impactful type things that included education. And I think one of the greatest things I was excited was when we were able to bring Region 8 out there and start linking them in with other groups like Mental Health America, and they're now doing some things. And you're seeing Josh Winning and Region 8 do things with Brenda Jank and Run Hard, Rest Well. So I smile when I see that because I'm going like, okay, I'm not saying I was responsible, but I got a chance to be on the whiteboard on some of that stuff. And that energized me. But I have been teaching for Purdue since I got here. I moved up to Fort Wayne when I took that job, and it wasn't long after that Wiley Sirk, who's a friend of former superintendent, friend, colleague, reached out and said, hey, could you jump in and teach a course for us? And I was glad to do that. Well, once you teach one, what you find is they call you back to teach at Excellence. So I've been adjuncting with Purdue for about 3 years. So this doesn't feel totally new in the sense of the program, but rather than being an adjunct, I'm excited about what full-time faculty status means in terms of freeing up some margin in my schedule, but I would do more work with schools again.
And it really is a small world. I ran into Wiley last night in Decatur at the concert series.
Yep.
Downtown, and you know, he's a city councilman there and walking around making sure everything's going well. And just shout out to Decatur. We moved it over spring break and we love it. They're doing so much stuff for their downtown, and it's less expensive to move there. Everybody's been great. And I'm glad Wiley's a part of the city leadership there, and also in his role in leadership at Purdue. You're the third guest that's brought up Run Hard, Rest Well. Why?